Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei has warned against attempts by enemies to frustrate people and lower the turnout in the presidential election. Iran's foreign minister, in a phone call with his British counterpart, both stressed the need to resume full compliance with the JCPOA. And a number of Palestinians injured by Israeli forces during latest protests in the occupied West Bank soars to 293. Hello everyone, and thank you for tuning in at World News. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has warned against enemies' attempts to create rifts between the Iranian people and the Islamic establishment. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was addressing the nation on the 32nd anniversary of the passing of Iran's Islamic Republic's founder, Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Khamenei highlighted the significance of the elections in the country, stressing Imam Khomeini viewed elections as a manifestation of people's will and stood firm against hegemony and corruption. Ayatollah Khamenei also referred to the upcoming presidential vote. He said that existing shortcomings should not discourage people from political participation. The leader also recommended that people consider deeds rather than words of presidential hopefuls and urged the candidates to avoid making hollow promises. He urged influential figures to encourage people to participate in the upcoming election. Iran's foreign minister has urged the U.S. to stop using economic war as leverage in negotiations held to salvage the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the call in a phone conversation with his British counterpart. He also stressed that Washington must fully return to obligations under the nuclear accord that is known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Zarif said that he and British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab have agreed on the necessity of resuming full compliance with the nuclear deal. The U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions against Iran, prompting remedial commitment cuts from Tehran. Iran and the remaining signatories are now engaged in talks to try to revive the accord. Iran has repeatedly emphasized that Washington has to take the first step by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Israeli forces have injured nearly 300 Palestinians during anti-settlement protests in the north of the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society said 26 people were hit by live rounds in the villages of Beita and Beit Dajan, both near the city of Nablus. The Israeli military also reportedly used drones to disseminate poisonous gas throughout the protests. The Palestinians were protesting against the construction of a new settlement outpost on top of the Sibeh Mountain. Israeli forces also injured at least 25 Palestinians in the Silwan neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Also, Israeli forces attacked and dispersed people taking part in a marathon. Now, the race was aimed at raising awareness about dozens of Palestinian families facing eviction in Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah neighborhoods. Political commentator Kevin Barrett says that Israeli forces have been brutalizing Palestinian protesters with impunity for decades.
This is a regular occurrence, and it hardly ever gets covered in the Western mainstream media. Palestinians have been mostly peacefully protesting for just asking for the same rights as the squatters and invaders who came and stole their land. This has been going on for decades. And the response to the protests is typically the Israelis put them down violently, often with live rounds and actually murdering and deliberately crippling huge numbers of peaceful protesters. Just 3 years ago, in spring of 2018, the Great March of Return protests, which were peaceful protests of large numbers of Palestinians approaching the apartheid border walls, were met with massive live fire. I think over 300 were killed and 18,000 injured, including thousands of children. Many of them were deliberately shot in the kneecaps and permanently crippled. Israeli soldiers bragged about the record for one of them getting something like, I think it was 48 knees in one day. That's the big front page headline in Haaretz. So this brutal reaction to peaceful protests like marathons, people trying to run a marathon and then get shot at and attacked and beat up and gassed and so on. This just goes to show what's really happening in occupied Palestine, which is a slow motion genocide.
For a second week, thousands of activists in northern England have protested outside a major British arms factory, BAE Systems, condemning the firm for arms sales to Israel. Anger comes after weeks of Israeli aggression against Palestinians, including the killing of innocent children in Gaza. Robert Carter has your story from the scene.
Hundreds of British pro-Palestine activists amassed outside a notorious arms manufacturer near Blackburn on Friday, demanding an end to Israeli arms sales. Anger was vented in various ways, including with a funeral procession honoring the recent martyrdom of over 60 children slain in Gaza.
It's a genocide that's occurring before our eyes. Companies like BAE Systems are complicit in what's going on there. They're providing illegal weaponry.
Now they've been exposed, the Zionist regime, because from footage from underground, from Gaza, has come out. And people are starting to realize that this is an apartheid, ethnic cleansing, colonialism regime that is operating, and it has to end.
Today, we came here to send a message to the world. What is the mistake of these children? 64 children have been killed, innocent. Some of them were sleeping in the hands of their parents, and they found themselves dead. Why? One, the answer is occupation. In the occupation, everything will be sorted out.
BAE Systems is one of Britain's biggest arms dealers and is known for building weapons used by Middle Eastern regimes to target innocent civilians in conflict zones.
Essentially here to register our protest and say to BAE Systems and to the government that this is simply unacceptable, that weapons manufactured here in Lancashire, here in England, should be used against civilians in Gaza and in Palestine.
This is the second week that local residents have come in good numbers to condemn BAE Systems, and more action is being planned. Major arms firms such as this have been heavily criticized many times in the past. However, it's very rare for protest movements of this size and frequency to engage in such regular and very direct action. Now, these locals are coming out in numbers, hoping to force a change which will inevitably save lives in places like Palestine and elsewhere too. Robert Carter, Blackburn.
China has accused the U.S. of suppressing its firms after Washington blacklisted more Chinese companies. Beijing's urged Washington to respect market laws and principles. It's also promised retaliation if the bans persist. On Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden added 28 Chinese companies to a list of firms that American entities are prevented from investing in. The list already contained 31 companies, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, had already blacklisted. Washington accuses all these companies of having links to China's defense or surveillance technology sectors. Bans have been among issues of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past year. The Russian president has slammed the U.S. for using the dollar as a political and economic weapon. Vladimir Putin warned that Russia may now turn to other currencies to conduct oil and gas transactions. Earlier, we discussed this issue in our news review program. Here it is.
On this edition, the Russian president has deplored the U.S.'s use of the dollar as a tool of economic and political war. At an annual economic forum in St. Petersburg, Vladimir Putin warned that Russia may consider settling transactions for oil and gas in other national currencies and the euro. He said it would be a serious blow to the U.S. dollar if Russia's oil companies stop using the currency. Russia announced Thursday that it would completely remove the U.S. greenback from its national wealth fund and turn the dollar-denominated assets into euros, yuan, and gold. Russia has long advocated a move away from the use of the dollar as the default global currency of trade and transactions. It says U.S. imposition of sanctions and its unpredictable economic policy have undermined the reliability of the American currency. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have historian, analyst, and author Mr. Markus Papadopoulos, joining us from the British capital, London. Also joining us from Moscow, we have journalist and political commentator Mr. Fred Weir. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Papadopoulos in London. Walk us through the recent comments made by the Russian president.
Well, America's stranglehold over most parts of the world is on account of a number of factors, which includes American military might and American culture, such as Hollywood and Netflix. But the foremost factor in accounting for American global supremacy is the dollar. Indeed, the Soviet Union ultimately lost the Cold War because the dollar triumphed over the ruble. Therefore, it is only logical and prudent for President Vladimir Putin to argue that the dollar needs to be replaced, because the Russian leadership is acutely aware that the American state uses the dollar in part to limit Russian progress, domestically and to limit Russian progress internationally. However, undermining the dollar is going to be an exceptionally difficult task for any leader in the world who seeks to enhance the national security of his country, because the American economy is supreme. Wherever America has a presence in the world, and as I said moments ago, America has a presence in most parts of the world, the American economy is integrated into the economies of, for instance, Latin America or Southeast Asia or parts of Africa or indeed the Middle East. And at the core of that integration is the dollar. So whilst Russia could limit itself when it comes to the use of the dollar, ultimately many countries in the world are heavily reliant, heavily dependent on the dollar. And it is my conviction that these countries will be most reluctant to relinquish their economic ties with the Americans. But also, I think there is a bigger picture at play, and one that I believe the Russian leadership needs to take into consideration when they carry out their strategic planning. And it is this. Whilst Russia is part of the global banking system, they are vulnerable to America and, of course, Britain, because the global banking system was established by Britain and then has been enhanced by America since the end of the Second World War. In short, the Americans and the British are in charge of the global banking system. So therein lies a weakness for the Russian Federation. They are part of a club, so to speak, in which the people in charge of the club are America and Britain, two countries which pose an immense threat, political, economic, and military threat to the national security of the Russian Federation. So I do submit that the Russian leadership do need to take into account that Russia's membership of the global banking system may, on the one hand, pay dividends, but on the other hand, does make Russia somewhat beholden to Washington and London.
Fred Weir, let's get your thoughts on the issue of Vladimir Putin. He's warned that Russia may consider a settling transaction for oil and gas and other national currencies, including the euro. How big of a blow would that be to the U.S.'s dollar, the U.S.'s currency?
It depends on whether other countries would join in that. It's a complicated thing because it's awfully important in international trade to have a currency that's stable. And the Russian ruble isn't that. It's gone through wild fluctuations in the past decade. Even the British pound isn't exactly stable. The U.S. dollar has been the mainstay of world trade, not only in oil, but a lot of things for a long time. But Russia could do that. It could get a basket of currencies that people would pay for their oil in. It's not just that Russia and China have been talking for a long time about de-dollarization. That's a thing. Russia has eliminated all of its deposits in the Federal Reserve, you know, T-bills. And now they're moving more. And they're not just doing that to kind of undercut the U.S. dollar, but because Putin has said several times that he thinks the dollar is going to crash for other reasons. For instance, massive social spending in the United States, like real huge quantities of unprecedented amounts of deficit spending. The U.S. dollar's days are numbered. That's what the Russian leaders say. So they're saying, we're getting out of the dollar, putting our own assets into other currencies, other commodities like gold, and they recommend that everybody else should too.
All right, thank you for your comments. Journalist and political commentator Fred Weir joining us from Moscow. Also thanks to historian, analyst, and author Mr. Markus Papadopoulos speaking to us from London.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@ irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the all-compassionate, the all-merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last week. And here is Ayah 36 of Surah Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
إنما الحياة الدنيا لعب وله وإن تؤمنوا وتتقوا يؤتكم أجوركم ولا يسألكم أموالكم.
The life of this world is just play and diversion. But if you are faithful and God-weary, He will give you your rewards and will not ask your wealth in return from you. If you remember, in our explanation of the preceding ayah of this surah last Friday, we said the true believers should never be apprehensive of their small number or shortage of facilities vis-a-vis the enemy. For God is with the faithful, and He will ultimately grant them victory. In other words, faith is not compatible with slackening, laziness, and comfort-seeking. Which means the faithful should never seek compromise with the enemy, either on the battlefield or at the negotiating table, since this is a sign of weakness and fear. But if the enemy proposes peace on fair conditions, they may accept it after due evaluation, rather than giving all concessions and receiving none, which means bowing to blackmail. The ayah that we recited to you is continuation of the warning against frailty and complacency against disbelievers, and refers to the main cause of frailty, that is, attachment to worldly possessions. Many people regard the world as the scene of pastime and pleasure, while the true believers consider it as the scene of divine manifestations and a blessing to gain the rewards of afterlife. It could be said that this ayah encourages Muslims to obey God, fulfill their duties, and do not shun the issue of jihad. It also refers to the vanity of mundane life, since worldly attachments serve as a factor hindering people from engagement in jihad. Among the factors for attachment to the world are quests for wealth and power. And those who acquire wealth rarely spend it in the way of God.
their likeness is that of travelers who forget the destination by being fascinated by the roadside scenarios. In contrast, the true believers do appreciate the beautiful scenes during their journey, abstain from ugly sights, and tolerate the hardships, but never think of the world as the permanent abode, because the destination is much more enchanting. Naturally, they neither covet wealth nor crave power, because they know that everything is from God, and that greed and stinginess impede the swift movement on the road of life. Thus, whatever they have acquired, they spent from it generously in the way of God on orphans, the needy, and the like, as well as for jihad, since it is important to defend the country, safeguard independence, maintain peace and security, and develop the infrastructure. From this ayah, we learn that, number one, excessive attachment to the world and its pleasures result in forgetting the hereafter, while true believers are never distracted by material life. Number two, though money and property are among the requirements of life, we should enjoy them according to our modest needs instead of amassing them. And number three, God has promised rewards for good deeds without taking anything in return. Now let us listen to ayah 37 of the same surah.
إن يسألكموها فيحفكم تبخلوا ويخرج أضغانكم.
Should he ask it from you and press you, you will be stingy and he will expose your spite. This ayah indicates the attachment of some persons to worldly possessions to the extent that even if God asks them for anything, they will harbor ill will because of their stinginess and spite. In fact, this ayah serves as a reproach to those entrapped in such attachments, while for the God-weary, it is a source of encouragement for detachment from the pull of material life. Thus, God Almighty, through such reproach, awakens the dormant souls in order to free them from the shackles of mundane possessions through sacrifices in the divine path, while beseeching him to bestow faith, piety, and satisfaction. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, everything including wealth, power, and life is from God and should be spent in his way without any stinginess. Number two, God hasn't levied any huge taxes, and whatever the noble Quran says about the zakat and khums to be paid by the rich is only a meager percentage of what he has granted them of wealth to test their faith. And number three, refusal and stinginess in this regard only expose such persons as a stingy, spiteful, and thankless. Now let us listen to ayah 38, the last one of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
Ha antum ha'ulai tud'auna litunfiqu fi sabilillahi faminkum man yabqal. وَمَنْ يَبْخَلْ فَإِنَّمَا يَبْخَلُ عَنْ نَفْسِهِ وَاللَّهُ الْغَنِيُّ وَأَنْتُمُ الْفُقَرَاءُ وَإِنْ
تتولوا يستبدل قوما غيركم ثم لا يكونوا أمثالكم.
Ah, there you are, being invited to spend in the way of Allah. Yet among you, there are those who are stingy. Whoever is stingy only to his or herself. Allah is the all-sufficient, and you are all needy. And if you turn away, He will replace you with another people, and they will not be like you. This ayah calls on Muslims to spend in the way of Allah by helping others, but they should be free to think and make their choice. Those who are stingy should not think that God is in need of them and their possessions, since it is we who are in need of God, the All-Sufficient, because without His mercy and the relief He has accorded us, we would have perished. In other words, the rich but stingy persons who do not pay the meager amounts of zakat and homes, as well as those who do not contribute to jihad, which guarantees the country's independence and dignity, or those fleeing from it on fear of losing lives, deprive themselves of the bounties of God and His rewards in the hereafter. The last phrase of the ayah is a warning to the Arab Muslims to appreciate the great divine favor of raising the last and greatest prophet amongst them. But if they continue their disobedience and thanklessness, God Almighty will raise another people far superior to them in terms of sacrificing their life and possessions in the cause of Allah. According to exegetes of the Noble Quran, both Sunni and Shia Muslims, when the companions of the Prophet asked who are the people mentioned in this ayah, he put his hand on the shoulder of his Iranian companion Salman Farsi and said, "This man and his people. By the one in whose hand is my life, if faith is placed in their plates, they will acquire it." The Prophet's 16th infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, is reported to have said in this regard, "By God, He has kept His promise, and a far better non-Arab people have replaced them." Taking a glance without any prejudice at the history of Islam and Islamic sciences, we discover that many non-Arab Muslims, particularly the Iranians, have greatly contributed to jihad against the enemies of faith and humanity, while their achievements in the field of Islamic sciences are evident to all. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, stinginess is not in compliance with faith, and everyone should spend in the way of God according to their financial ability, with full knowledge that the Almighty Creator is all-sufficient. Number two, those who fulfill their duties are assured of divine rewards, both in this world and the hereafter. And number three, the independence of the country, the dignity of its people, and the peace and development of the society are ensured through proper spending of wealth and sacrifices offered by the nation. Dear listeners, we have reached the end of Surah Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Inshallah, next week we will start explanation of the next surah, that is Fatih. God bless you and goodbye.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's segment of Back to Reality, brought to you by Arab English Radio. I am your humble host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have the pleasure of hosting two wonderful guests. I'll leave the introduction to themselves.
I'm Mudaffar Haider, at your service today.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for joining us.
And I'm Hasnain Ali. Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum wa rahmatullah. In memory of the great, I would like to think of him as the great scholar and mystic, Ayatollah Ruhullah al-Musawi al-Khomeini. Brother Mudaffar, when you hear that name, Khomeini, what's the first thought that comes to your mind?
One of the most inspirational things that I heard about Imam Khomeini when I was only a kid was when he had accomplished the revolution, you know, all these crowds are coming out, that, you know, he puts one hand up in the air and the crowds just go wild. I mean Westerners will be familiar with rock concerts and celebrities and stuff. Hey man, that is nothing compared to the love that surrounded this man. They are willing to give their lives for him. So somebody comes to Imam Khomeini and they say, all these people love you so much, they're in love with you. And how does that make you feel? Imam Khomeini says, well, nothing really. Then he said, what do you mean? So Imam Khomeini says, look, if the people love me for what I'm saying, I'm still going to say it. And if they hate me for what I'm saying, I'm still going to say it, because it's the truth. He didn't live his life for people or for money or for politics or for any other reason except for Allah. Except for Allah.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
That's another quality about Imam Khomeini that I admire so much, and I feel like even as youth we can incorporate into our lives, the amount of ikhlas, the sincerity that he had in every action, right? And like, he trusted in God so much, and that's the only thing that kept him going despite all the odds.
Right.
They were trying to kill him, they arrested him, they exiled him, they threatened his family, but he was so sure that this is the words of Allah that I need to carry out, I need to do this for these Muslim people.
So I just remember that Imam Khomeini was really fond of kids.
He was.
Yeah, so like Imam Khomeini, like, he was a serious man, he was a man of his words, he was a man of the principles. But still, when we talk to his family members, we get to know he was a good man. Like,
in the house, his face changed, man.
Exactly.
That frown
every
just went.
Picture you see with his grandkids, he has this slight smile, even an ear to ear with his
smile,
children.
Man.
Exactly.
You know, doing all this work for Islam, he still used to go to his house and he used to sit with his family members and listen to their issues. And, you know, once when, you know, usually the granddaughters used to visit him, then he used to ask, like, where's your child? Then I was reading this conversation, like, between Imam Khomeini and his granddaughter. So he asked him, like, where's your child? He's like, I didn't get him because I thought, like, you'll get disturbed. So, like, I'm disturbed by this, that you did not get him.
Remember once he had guests and he rolled up his sleeves and started washing the dishes.
That's beautiful. This man is probably, like, one of the most well-known personalities of modern era, I guess. But then he's like, he didn't feel like, oh, but I'm such an important person now, you know?
Exactly.
What am I going to do, wash this just for you, dude? No. And when we were talking about his relationship with his family members, did you guys know that he actually wrote poetry for his daughter-in-law? Her name was Fatima. Her name is Dr. Fatima Tabatabai, and wrote poetry for her. That's how well he vibed with his family
members.
That's so
beautiful, yeah.
And it just... it reminds me of Rasulullah. I can't help it. Every aspect, almost every aspect of Imam Khomeini's characteristics and personality reminds me of Rasulullah. That multifaceted thing he's got going on reminds me of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi.
Here on Back to Reality with my two special guests, we're talking about the most distinguished, important, prominent, and wonderful qualities and features of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah alayh. I want to talk more about what do you guys think made Imam Khomeini the way he was? Let's start with the youngest.
Okay, so, you know, the love for God made him Imam Khomeini.
Mm, true.
You know, he had the love for God, and because he had the love for God, you know, he loved Haqq. He had that love for the truth.
Truth.
Yeah. So that made him Imam Khomeini, and, you know, being a servant of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, that he used to follow in the footsteps of the Aimma Athar alayhim salam. All his idea of establishing a Islamic Republic, you know, where did he learn from? Like, we have got plenty of ahadith, like Imams mentioning that, you know, we need to establish justice in the world. So he was, you know, this made him Imam Khomeini.
He had the practical steps that you need to take, and he also had those spiritual dimensions, and they came together. I mean, there's lots you can say about it. I mean, he had the most wonderful teachers. His teachers were the top caliber teachers in the entire world. He also had a good upbringing. He was also entered into the Khuzestan religious environment at the beginning of his, like, when he was very young, right? He also, you know, familiarized himself a lot with the Quran. But, you know, one of his favorite verses that he would often recite is La yukallifu Allahu nafsan illa wus'aha. No soul is burdened with a burden except to the extent of its ability. And if we look at it, there are so many other people who have had precisely the same thing. They've had amazing teachers. They've gone to the Hawza from a young age. They were also in a scholarly environment. They also entered that scholarly environment for a young age, and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
There is still something that makes Imam Khomeini stand out, and he was completely distinguished. And if I really try hard to find that trait and that quality which made him the way he was, I would circle right back again to that love that he had for Allah, for that sincerity, for that absolute
love
faith
that he had for Allah that led him, you know, the proper understanding from the religion. Like, he understood the religion properly, and, you know, he established the Wilayat al-Faqih and the Islamic government. You know, he understood the religion properly, and the words he used to mention, that Hasbunullah, that God is enough for us. That he said that we don't need to depend on anyone. Like, beat West, we can do everything. Like, that we can do anything, that God is enough for us. So he had that proper understanding from the religion.
Yes, made him Imam. He did. He had a very deep and very thorough understanding, comprehension of the religion of Islam.
He had that sort of mind. He would pick things apart and try to understand them in depth. And that's
genius,
why he was
yes.
so multifaceted. He was able to have a say, have an opinion, a valid opinion in so many different fields.
A valid Islamic opinion, yes. From the Quran, from the Ahadith, he was able to pass verdicts with certainty. There are very, very, very few individuals who can do that, first of all. But now, even when it comes to making those decisions, there are so many degrees and layers and just layers of repercussions to those actions. I want to give you an example, right? So when the revolution was sparked, there were a lot of people who were killed.
Yeah.
Some people, surprise, surprise, from the religious community came and confronted Imam Khomeini, and they said, you know, these people have died. Who is responsible for their deaths? Right, there was lots of attacks that were taking place from Iraq and, you know, from Saddam Hussein and the enemies of Islam and the rest. So he actually said, "I will bear the responsibility of this on the Day of Judgment."
He was so sure of what
he was
doing.
Certain of what he was doing.
That's so important, though. How often are we sure, Brother Hassanain? I think as students of the Seminary of Qom. Mm. We've all had some of his books in our curriculums, right?
When did they ever put Imam Khomeini's book in the curriculum?
I studied like 4 of his books at least.
In
and
the
I
curriculum?
Gave Have you read any of his works? He was a writer since like his youth years. His first tafsir, it was tafsir of the supplication of Sahar of Ramadan, was at when he was 19.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Have you read any of his books, Brother Hasnain?
Okay, so actually, I didn't want to break this out, but I have listened to his speeches, but I've not read specifically a book written by him, and that's actually sad.
I recommend 40 Hadith, the Arba'een book. It's a very beautiful book. It's a little hardcore. I mean...
A little hardcore?
No. More on the more...
As you said, it's in the curriculum, right? So I have not yet reached there.
Sure. Keep telling yourself that. What other books did we have? Asrar al-Salah?
Adab al-Salah.
Adab al-Salah. There we go. That was one of his books.
If there's any book you read, read Chil Hadith. But Adab al-Salah is incredible too.
It is.
It is such an amazing book.
I recommend it to
book.
Our listeners. If they can find it in English or if they understand Farsi or Arabic, go for it.
And the translation is fantastic.
You've read it in English?
Yeah.
Awesomeness.
I think I've read two different translations as well. They were both really, really good.
Alhamdulillah.
I think. But, you know, that shows you the depth of this man.
And his eloquence.
Oh.
You see how different it is, his speech, when he's talking to the normal, like, layman, the people, the civilians, the population, and then his book. See, it's like different personalities.
Let me tell you something. Chil Hadith, 40 Hadith, the book. Read the first chapter. Read the second one. Read the third one. Fourth one, okay. Fifth one, you're getting deeper now. Sixth one, seventh one, eighth one. What is going on
exactly.
here?
Exactly. Where am I?
I need to start again. That's what happens. Every time, you just end up starting again. Adab al-Salah is the same way. He is, when you start one of his books, he is taking you on a journey. And along the way, you just, because you haven't been following very, very particularly and very closely, you start to get lost.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, I need to retrace my steps, start again.
Like, start all over
try and
again.
Figure this out from the beginning.
One book by him, like, which I read, like, a few pages from it, is The Greatest Jihad, like, Combat with the Self.
Yeah.
Like, it's about all, you know, jihad and nafs. Yeah.
Right, the book Jihad. And, like, from the titles of these books, like, I think if we read just these three books from Imam Khomeini, we're set for life.
Yeah,
because what else do we need to fix about ourselves? We need to fix our salah, our prayer.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be able to fight with the temptations of the lower self.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to know about the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, the 40 Hadith. Khalas, that's like basically... another interesting aspect of Imam Khomeini, another feature of his, is that he was a very powerful man, no doubt. But he was not wealthy at all. He was actually an orphan. I don't know how many people know that. His father was killed when he was very young. He was raised by his mom and his aunt.
Mm-hmm.
His house in Qom was a simple house. Right now, it's like sort of a tourist attraction. People go and visit like Imam Khomeini's old house. But the house that his wife passed away in like a few years back, which is in Jamaran of Tehran, also a very simple house, nothing schmancy. I think his sitting room don't even have couches, or maybe they do have like these really old beat-up couches.
Yeah.
His outfits were always so simple, his clothes, his lifestyle, and it just makes you wonder. When you look at like presidents, prime ministers, generals, kings, queens of the Western world, or even the Eastern, They're living the luxurious life, right?
Yeah.
They're like living their best material life. But Imam Khomeini, he was so detached from all these things.
And Imam Khomeini was more powerful than any of them.
He really was.
Exactly.
Any of them.
Imagine this old man in his 80s waving his hand, saying one word, and millions of people just pledging their lives for him. That's all the time we have for today's episode of Back to Reality. Thank you so very much for being with us today as we did our part in the best of our capability to commemorate the great man who was Sayyid Ruhullah al-Musawi al-Khomeini. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The Limelight.
Mohammad Taufiq Abdul Hadi, who lived with schizophrenia and was often found wandering in confusion through his Gaza neighborhood, was shot dead by Israeli regime forces near the border fence, says Heb Jamal, journalist, in an article titled "Israeli Regime Kills Palestinians with Mental Illness Through Impunity." Stay tuned for more. On May 30, it will be 1 year since Israeli regime border police killed Iyad al-Halak, an autistic Palestinian man. The police claimed that Halak had an object that looked like a pistol and ran away when ordered to stop. Halak was unarmed. Halak attended and worked at a special needs facility in Al-Quds Old City, meters from where he was shot. Israeli regime police started chasing him after they suspected he was a terrorist because he was wearing gloves. While Halak was trying to hide behind a large rubbish bin, fearing for his life, Israeli regime police shot and killed him. The killing of Palestinians with mental illness is not unusual for the fake regime of Israel. After the recent 11-day Israeli regime assault on Gaza, which killed at least 248 Palestinians, including 66 children and 39 women, and injured hundreds more, Palestinians have held their breath while searching for the missing. One of the victims, Mohammad Taufiq Abdul Hadi, he was found dead in an open area east of Gaza City near the border fence. Mohammad was not killed by an airstrike or the impact of a bomb. He was shot by Israeli regime troops in cold blood. Mohammad lived with various conditions, including schizophrenia and depression. When on medication, he was alert and available to his family and only son. Without his medication, though, Mohammad was often confused, known to wander through his neighborhood of Khan Yunis, although his family always eventually found him. When eyewitnesses saw Mohammad, a young man, walking towards the demarcation line and killed by an Israeli regime sniper, it was too dangerous to retrieve his body. No one could alert his family, and his body lay there for more than a week, all because he could not access his medications. Mohammad developed his conditions later in life when he was studying engineering in Germany. Although he had a bright future, social isolation and the troubles being an immigrant forced him to return to his home in Gaza. The indiscriminate killing of Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, does not even spare traumatized children. 11 of the children killed in Gaza this month were receiving trauma counseling to help them deal with life in a state of continuous war. More than two-thirds of children in Gaza experience psychological distress as the mental health crisis in the besieged enclave continues to grow. In one example, 22-year-old Fatih Harb went to a great march of return protest in 2018, counting on the indiscriminate killing of Israeli regime snipers to fatally shoot him. He was, it seems, trying to bring about his own death. When he was not killed by snipers, he set himself on fire on a busy street in Gaza City. The conditions of Gaza military siege and Israeli regime assaults every few years have exacerbated the territory's mental health crisis. The Gaza Community Mental Health Program has reported growing numbers of cases of anxiety, depression, and suicide. Beyond Gaza, this past February, the Zionist regime police killed Munir Anabtawi, a Palestinian man with mental illness in Haifa. Anabtawi reportedly had a psychotic episode after an argument with his mother, who tried to call an ambulance but accidentally died of the police, whose arrival led to her son's death. The police officer said he acted out of genuine concern for his life. Why five bullets? Fine, give him one. He's down. But one, and another, and another, and another. They neutralized him, the victim's brother told Channel 12 in March, accusing the Zionist regime police of having assassinated Anabtawi. The officer involved was cleared of wrongdoing by the Zionist regime's justice ministry earlier this month. The Zionist regime army on Twitter deemed its latest assault on Gaza to have been a success. That number presumably includes Palestinians who are vulnerable or who have mental health conditions, such as Mohammed Abdul Hadi. The fake regime of Israel can kill those with mental illness with impunity. May you rest in peace, Mohammed, along with every other Palestinian with mental illness who has been victimized by the Zionist regime's brutal military occupation.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.